absolutely intercultural.
Fullständig tvärkulturell.
Absolut interkulturalisch.
Absolutamente interkulturell.
Absolutely intercultural.
Welcome to Absolutely Intercultural, the podcast about all things intercultural. My name's Anne Fox, and this is show 256, coming to you from Denmark. In this show, we'll be talking to Frank Toms, whose new book, Behind the Red Veil, came out just recently. As a young teacher in the US, Frank was very curious about the USSR, the old Soviet Union, before it broke up into Russia and the different states again in the 1990s. On a teacher exchange, what did he find out about Soviet teachers?
And there's a famous saying about in the Soviet Union that teachers look through their fingers at what's going on, meaning they see but don't say.
Then I talked to Kim Corbin, a teacher in Canada who specializes in diversity and inclusion. What was her advice to teachers about how to be more culturally responsive in the classroom?
I just think one of the most important things is just to educate yourself. It's an ongoing process. We cannot shy away from our history, as uncomfortable as it must be.
For those of you under 40 years old, I have to remind you that the Soviet Union in the 1980s was a very cut-off and controlled country. So when Frank Toms made his first visit to the Soviet Union for a teacher exchange, he wasn't allowed to go where he pleased. His latest book is called Beyond the Red Veil, A U.S. School Teacher's Adventures in Gorbachev's Russia. And so I started by asking about that title, Beyond the Red Veil. Let's go absolutely red.
Well, the Red Veil, it came when I first got there with Nina, our first and tourist guide. She put us on a bus. They kept us in international hotels. We only shopped in Berdyoska shops. We basically stayed in a cocoon. We were supposed to be in a cocoon the entire time we were there. And I said, well, what is this veneer? What is it that we're not able to see? And I wanted to see real Russians. And as I told you, I met three of them in the first 2 days on my own. I had skipped the tour somehow. I got out of it and got, and particularly in the airport, before I even met the tour, this woman came up and started talking to me in Russian. And I had 10 days of Russian the summer before, and I understood what she was saying. So I answered her terribly, but I did, and ended up getting her phone number. So the veneer bothered me. And then later when I was writing the book, I was looking for a title that would work for my story. And all the titles just didn't help it. When I came up with this idea, well, maybe there's a red veil. There's something in front of everybody who comes to there, who looks at the Soviet Union, that hides what's really going on. It's the government propaganda. It's the what they tell their people about how good they are. It's about how they take foreigners and put them in a cocoon and keep them out. And it's the way they present themselves to the world at large. We're the world's mightiest nuclear power. We have a great economy. We are a great peoples. No drugs here and all that kind of stuff. And I realized it's just not true. So how can I make, getting behind the Iron Curtain was easy. I just flew over it. It was a done deal. But there was this reason, and a lot of people come back now, even from St. Petersburg, and tell me, oh my God, Russia is so much better than it was. The people are so much better off, and they're not. I wanted to go last spring, but the COVID kept that away. I was gonna go back and go look for the real Russians again. So the red veil was that thing that I got behind, and once I got behind it, I found out all kinds of wonderful stories and people and ideas and about the culture and how much the people were very much like my people, our people. So
we'll be talking with Frank again later in the show about the teaching he witnessed. In the meantime, on our website at absolutely-intercultural.com, you'll find links to Frank's book, as well as all the other stuff we mentioned during the show. Kim Corbin in Canada is a teacher who specialized in diversity, equity, and inclusion in the classroom. And this includes making sure that cultural diversity is reflected in school as a matter of everyday practice and not just on special let's go round the world cooking days. The coaching and educational professional development company, Powerful Learning Practice, or just PLP, has hired Kim to help other teachers to implement cultural diversity in the classroom. So let's go absolutely culturally responsive and find out more about what Kim does for PLP.
So in the PLP role, I'm there as a consultant to be an oversight for equity, accessibility, and anything to deal with culturally responsive education. For example, are we connecting to the experience, lived experiences, the cultural knowledge of students? How are we incorporating anti-racism, anti-racist ideas in the classroom, giving teachers practical strategies that they can include? There's a lot of information out there. So for my, this is coming from my research experience, there's a lot of information, but what are the practical strategies that will work in the classroom for teachers to actually attain culture responsive equity or anti-racist education?
I think Canada, or is it more specifically Ontario, may be one of the few places that has a culturally responsive framework in place. I think Australia is another place that has done something specifically about that,
yeah.
But they're very much the outliers. Is it just the state or is it the whole country?
It's the whole country. Yeah, and you can definitely see every province and territory really emphasizing the need for culture responsive education, connecting it to Indigenous education, indigenizing the curriculum, because there is an awakening in Canada of recognizing the historical legacies, the colonial legacies that have impacted Indigenous communities, Indigenous nations. And how can we use equity, anti-racism, and culture-responsive education as an awakening, as an enlightening, and to take steps forward in the truth and reconciliation with Indigenous communities?
It sounds as though Canada is quite far ahead in that respect.
Yes, I am. I'm happy with the progress, and but as always, a lot more needs to be a lot more needs to be accomplished, and. I'm happy to be being a part of that work because I think it's very important and I want to continue, and we need to hit deeper in addressing the historical wrongs that we've done through education and sometimes still do through education. And even current wrongs, not just historical, because some of the wrongs are current.
Are you optimistic?
Yes, I am optimistic. I've, you know, talking to family members, I have seen change, but is more change needed? Definitely. You have to be hopeful. I am hopeful. I want to be hopeful. I've seen it in the PLP community. I've seen it on the Twitter chats that we have with the community. And I see it in social media. I am hopeful. I see it. So I'm positive. And I think the best is going to come out of things and what we're doing and teaching. I do feel more people are valuing the need for change. Parents are talking about it with their kids at home. It's not just an education that there's an awareness, this enlightening. It's happening across all professions. It's just about doing it right, I would say. Building that value system, that value in change, and seeing value in other people. Because it is a systemic issue. And you mentioned that I was talking about that with someone in the community, PLP community, it is a systemic problem, but at the same time, the incremental changes at home, at work are important too, because those incremental changes will add up into larger changes. I just think one of the most important things is just to educate yourself. It's an ongoing process. We cannot shy away from our history, as uncomfortable as it must be. A part of culturally responsive education and equity is disrupting what we consider to be normal and to unlearn and to relearn in a new lens that is equitable, that does not perpetuate the past legacies of racism and harmful, divisive tendencies. Because although we are educators, it can come up still. It is implicit. Education was used as a tool of assimilation. And how can we eliminate and recognize when those instances come up again? So it's really about educating ourselves, being aware, and being able to identify and make necessary changes and valuing those changes.
So there is no hour on the timetable that says culturally responsive knowledge. It's got to be something
embedded.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's ongoing. You're right. It shouldn't be an add-on. It shouldn't be compartmentalized. As you said, it's just embedded into what we do, how we interact with students, teaching students interact, the materials that we bring in, the type of assessments that we use, because we do use a very traditional marking system of that is individualistic. We need to focus more on assessments that bring in other cultural norms of group work and interactions. Mm-hmm. So it's everything, as you said. It's everything: assessments, resource content, our interactions, and how we connect with our students, and the language we use too.
By the way, Kim shared a great image of the mindset of a culturally responsive educator, which consists of six different facets, including high expectations and desire to make a difference, as well as the core of culturally responsive teaching practices. The image is posted on the Absolutely Intercultural website at absolutely-intercultural.com. Let's hope more countries follow the lead of Canada and Australia to implement cultural diversity in the classroom. Now let's go back to Frank Toms and find out more about the sort of teaching methods he encountered in the Soviet Union. Let's go absolutely pedagogical.
You walk in the door, and as soon as you step in the door, all the kids stand up. And the teacher greets you, all that kind of stuff, and you go to the back of the room. You sit down and then you watch the pedagogy, and it's all over. Whether it was in Kazakhstan, in Moscow, Leningrad, schools I saw, the teacher, there's a textbook. The kid's job is to retell the text. So the teacher asks them questions to retell the text. So the teacher asks the question. Kids raise their hands at the elbow, right elbow. If they're called on, they stand up. Everybody else sits down. And if they're having trouble, there's whispering going on in the classroom to support the kid who's standing up. And the kid gives the answer. The teacher says, thank you. She hears the whispering, but she, you know, it's part of the pedagogy. The kid sits down with permission and folds his hands, you know, on the desk. The next question is asked. Another kid stands up, and so it goes in every classroom. It's basically that pedagogy. That's the Soviet pedagogy, nationally speaking. So I would start teaching class, but the first class I taught, none of that happened. It was a bunch of 16-year-olds, and they just had a conversation about Oscar Wilde. I think that's what it was about. But the other classes I went to, the kids all scrambled in, looked at the American like, ah, and I would do the start retelling the text thing, because I was told to teach this particular lesson. And, you know, they would do exactly the same thing with me until I asked a personal question. Then the hands just shot up off the table. People wanted to talk. I was like an Aladdin, you know, seeking to release the genie of themselves, you know, little kids. And the big kids would just, it was just, as soon as I stepped out of the Soviet pedagogy and was myself, the whole room completely shifted. And I had so much fun because I could use humor, stick figures on the board, jokes, walking up and down, squatting down below, looking at them at the same eye level, and things that teachers never did because they were told to stand in front and do their thing. So, and I got away with it everywhere, and it was no problem because I was an exchange teacher. But the pedagogy is national, and So I could just do what I wanted. And by the time I was teaching the last school in 1991, the 16-year-olds and I were talking about reincarnation and afterlife and really serious conversations about what the meaning of life was all about. So it was quite a range, but a lot of it depended on sort of releasing the genie in them. In the larger classes, like chemistry or physics, they were mostly lecture courses where the teacher would basically lecture and ask some questions during the class. And every kid had to be graded every day in every class. And they had to do their homework for every class. And they had 6 or 7 classes a day, and they never could do all their homework. They could never get it all done. So they all cheated with each other. They all copied each other's homeworks and stuff. And the teachers knew that, but that's what the system was, so oppressive to everybody, including the teachers, that they all had to find a way to survive it. Mm-hmm. That's how I saw it anyway. Yeah. And I think I was pretty much right on.
But presumably stuff was learned. Maybe not as much as
But curiously, one girl really befriended me. And in my book, she is the girl in the chapter called She, which is a pronoun only. There's no name of anybody in that chapter. And she was the first to tell me that students cheated on exams and tests all the time. And she showed me how. And she even showed me a Bic pen, which I still have upstairs in my study. A Bic pen clear with chemistry formulas wrapped around the inside inkwell. So in the chemistry exam, she could turn her pen and see the formulas she needed to answer the questions. And for exams, she prepared 25 answer sheets for the questions that were going to be asked. And after she did hers, she gave those sheets out to her friends so they would have the correct answers when they came. And there's a famous saying about in the Soviet Union that teachers look through their fingers at what's going on, meaning they see but don't say. Mm-hmm. They see the cheating. They know the cheating. Some classes hid exam answers in rooms underneath books and stuff like that. So when the kids came out of the exam room, they could find one. Another kid who had a friend who didn't do well in physics, Mark, when he got through answering his question, he was higher in the alphabet. So he marked his thing on a little piece of red on the back of the sheet. And all those questions were in a box. So when his friend came in, he looked for the one that had a red mark on it. So his friend already knew the answer, so he could pass. And he did. I mean, and it goes way back in history. People told me about it happening before. And it's just part of the way it works. So the Soviet educational system presented to the world in front of the red veil in my concept of the book looked like the kids were having lots of classes and mastering material when they were surviving by helping each other, and teachers looking through the fingers knew what was happening. It was absolutely fascinating. And they were all up front about it with me. I found out all I could. I never had to scramble to figure out what was going on because the kids all told me. Because Gorbachev, during that time, was asking people to investigate themselves as living in a communist society. So they did it with me. It was a perfect time for an American who is as curious as I am to be in that country. Because people were easily let their tongues loose when they had a chance.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this tour of the classrooms of the Soviet Union and Canada. Thank you to Kim Corbin and Frank Toms, who were willing to share their experiences. If you have an idea for a future show, then you can get in touch with us through our website at www.absolutely-intercultural.com or as a message to our Facebook page, where we post interesting links several times a week. We'd love a like on our Facebook page if you have one to spare. By the way, did you know that we're also on Apple Podcasts? You can subscribe to us there for free and give us a rating and a comment. We'd really appreciate that. So the next show is coming to you from Germany on December 4th with Laura Borgmann. So until then, stay tuned.
Absolutely intercultural.
Fullständigt tvärkulturell.
Absolut interkulturell.
Absolutamente intercultural.
Absolutely intercultural.